Welcome to The Last Month at the Federal Circuit, a look at recent Federal Circuit decisions impacting the intellectual property community. Today we are joined by Finnegan attorneys Kevin Rodkey and Beth Farrell. So Kevin, we're going to talk today about the en banc opinion decision issued in LKQ versus GM on May 21st. First, just tell us what happened.
Sure. So the end result was the en banc Federal Circuit overruled the Rosen-Durling test for determining whether a design patent is obvious under 35 U.S.C. 103. This case started out when LKQ filed an inter partes review challenging GM's design patent for the front fender of a car. And the petition raised a couple issues of invalidity, including anticipation and obviousness. And the board issued a final written decision finding that LKQ had not shown anticipation, but also that it had not shown obviousness under the Federal Circuit's Rosen-Durling test. For those of you who don't know, the Rosen-Durling test is an obviousness test for design patents that has two steps. In step one, the test asks whether a single reference or design has design characteristics that are basically the same as the claim design. And we'll come back to that basically the same requirement later. And under step two, it asks if there is a design that's basically the same, does the secondary reference, is it so related to the primary reference in appearance of the ornamental features that it would suggest the application of those features to the primary reference? And the board found that LKQ hadn't met these tests. The primary reference was not basically the same as GM's claimed design. And so the board found there was no obviousness under that test. LKQ then appealed to the Federal Circuit. And on appeal, one of the arguments that LKQ raised was whether the Supreme Court's decision in KSR from 2007 effectively abrogated the Rosen-Durling test, arguing that the Rosen-Durling test was too narrow in light of the KSR guidance. But the panel decision of the Federal Circuit affirmed the board's decision and basically said that it didn't have the authority to overrule Rosen and Durling because it didn't have clear directives from the Supreme Court. LKQ then requested en banc hearing. The full court took this up, and it overruled Rosen and Durling and the Rosen-Durling test, and then remanded back to the board to consider the arguments again, the art again, in light of this decision.
All right. Well, thanks, Kevin. So why did the court overturn the Rosen-Durling framework?
Yeah, basically what it determined, and it looked at a lot of pieces, but it basically said that the Rosen-Durling test was too restrictive when viewed in light of the Supreme Court's precedent. And it spent a lot of time looking at the precedent in KSR and Graham versus John Deere, and then a case from the 1800s called Whitman Saddle. And the court made several observations when it decided to overrule Rosen-Durling, but basically it noted, starting that both design patents and utility patents have to meet the statutory framework under Section 102, Section 103, and the other sections of Title 35. And it sort of addressed these in turn in the test for Rosen-Durling, starting with basically the same requirement, the first part of the test. And the court found that that was overly restrictive in light of the precedent. It looked in particular at the Whitman Saddle opinion from the 1800s. When the Supreme Court explained that in Whitman Saddle, the claimed saddle design was not inventive when it basically took the front half of one known saddle and the back half of another known saddle and put them together in a way that the ordinary saddler did customarily, and there was evidence in the record that they would just take parts of different saddles and put them together in new designs. And the court said that the Rosen requirement for basically the same was too rigid because if you applied that test to Whitman Saddle, the references in Whitman Saddle wouldn't meet the Rosen test, and then the Supreme Court's guidance really isn't met. The Supreme Court was using a more flexible test even back in the 1800s, and then you get to KSR and Graham, which also kind of uphold that more flexible requirement. So the en banc court found that basically the same requirement in the first part of the Rosen-Durling test was not flexible enough under the Supreme Court's guidance and overruled that part of the test. It then looked at the second part, the Durling so related requirement for the secondary reference, and basically reached the same conclusion that requiring the secondary reference to be so related to the primary one that it suggested its application to the primary reference was too restrictive. And it noted that this so related requirement looked a lot like the teaching suggestion motivation test for utility patents that the Supreme Court said was too inflexible in KSR, and kind of reached the same conclusion applying KSR's theory to the so related requirement. It again looked at Whitman Saddle, and again, those references that were in Whitman Saddle would not have met the Rosen-Durling test and the so related requirement. And so the court again said, look, this is too restrictive. You know, we need to overrule this part of the test and implement a new test.
And about that new test, what did the court provide any guidance about it? What does that look like?
They did. They provided some guidance. The court made some observations really by looking at the Graham versus John Deere framework. And that framework has four major parts. The first one is determining the scope and content of the prior art, determining the differences between the prior art and the claims at issue, the relatedness of the level of ordinary skill in the pertinent art, in this case, an ordinary designer in the art, and then what the court calls secondary indicia of non-obviousness, which have a number of factors that can indicate whether something may be obvious or may not be obvious based on those factors and the facts under them. And the court kind of looked at each of these and gave some general statements by comparing it to utility patents. Under the Graham factor one, the scope and content, the court observed that design patents still use something like the analogous art test to utility patents, but this test has two parts. In the first part, you look to whether the prior art is in the same field as the challenged design, much like utility patents. But the second part of that test, which looks at the problem being solved by the patent, may be less apparent in designs than it is in utility patents. And so the court kind of left that one alone. Looking to the differences between the prior art and the claim design, the court noted that you rely on the visual appearance, unlike utility patents, where you're looking more at the technical features of the various references in the patent being challenged. For Graham factor three and the level of ordinary skill in the art, again, the court kind of made its comparison to utility patents, but said that this time you're looking at the ordinary designer in the field, and again took its cue from the Supreme Court's Whitman Saddle decision, which looked to the ordinary saddler in the art. And then when you're taking these first three Graham factors together, the court kind of reaffirmed that you also have to have a motivation to put the references together to arrive at the visual appearance of the claim design, since these are design patents. And it reaffirmed its prior guidance and decisions that this motivation inquiry focuses on the visual impression of the claim design as a whole, not the individual design elements independently. And last, on secondary indicia of non-obviousness, again, the court kind of looked at how this might apply to designs compared to utility patents, because we're starting sort of from the same framework. And it said it doesn't disturb its own precedent in designs that you might look to things like commercial success, industry praise, and copying for design patents, much like utility patents. But there were some other indicia of non-obviousness, like failure of others to reach the claimed design, or a long-felt technological need that maybe is unsatisfied, that may apply to utility patents, and the court decided not to kind of go down that road as to what is and is not applicable at this point. But really, the takeaway from this guidance is the court's kind of going back to the basic principles of Graham, and we'll be looking at those Graham factors in more detail in later cases.
Thank you, Kevin. So Beth, let's talk about the similarities and differences between the new test and the Rosen-Durling framework. First, let's talk about the similarities. How is the new test similar to the Rosen-Durling framework?
So I think that it's actually quite similar. And I don't think that this is really surprising, given that Rosen-Durling, and it was really Rosen. It's kind of funny. I never called this the Rosen-Durling test before all this briefing. We just called it the Rosen test. But the Rosen test really finds its way back to Graham. You know, it goes through a case called Nobanian, but it makes its way back to Graham. And so I think saying that you're still relying on Graham means you're actually not changing the test very much. For example, we knew before that you needed to use analogous art, although the court did provide some additional guidance on what that means in the design context. We did know that from before. We also knew that determination of whether a reference is analogous art is a question of fact. We knew that from before. We also knew that your primary reference needed to be something in existence. This is an important requirement because it's a guard against hindsight. You're not allowed to find a reference and start making changes to it in order to try to get it across the line to be a primary reference. We also knew that the primary reference might render the design obvious without any secondary references. We knew that. And we also generally are going to continue to use the same definition of the designer of ordinary skill in the art. We also definitely had the concept of motivation to combine before. I think the concept is a bit broader now than it was before, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but we still had that concept. And in terms of the obviousness combination, that really is the same question. As Kevin mentioned, it's comparing the overall visual appearance of the prior designs with respect to the claim design from the perspective of the designer of ordinary skill. All of that is exactly the same under the new test as it was under the previous test. And we also knew from the Campbell Soup case, which came a couple of years ago, that secondary considerations is still an important factor in design patent obviousness. And really, the court pretty much just summarized what happened in the Campbell Soup case. They didn't really change anything there.
And so how is the new test different, I guess, from the Rosen framework?
Sure. So the new test is different in two ways. I think one is not much of a difference, and I think the other one really is quite a difference. So in terms of the first thing is the court, as Kevin pointed out, under the Rosen-Durling test, relied on this question of whether a primary reference was appropriate if it was basically the same, end quote, as the claim design. And the court has said, well, we're doing away with basically the same. And now the court has adopted, quote, visually similar to the claim design. I actually think, as Judge Lori pointed out in his concurrence, this is not really much of a change. I mean, arguably, it's a little bit looser than basically the same, but I think that my take on the LKQ case was always that the PTAB was applying basically the same to rigidly. It wasn't that basically the same was necessarily a problem. It was just that the PTAB had applied it quite rigidly. So now we have a new test, which is visually similar, but it seems to me that that's sort of a distinction without much of a difference. However, when it comes to how the primary reference and the secondary reference should be related to one another, I think that really is a difference. So what we used to have under Rosen-Durling was that the primary reference and the secondary reference needed to be, quote unquote, so related to each other. The application of that test was an understanding that was a relationship based on visual appearance when looking at the primary reference and looking at the secondary reference. Although it was possible to argue for a motivation to combine that came outside of those references, it wasn't very common. And so what we see in the LKQ opinion is that the court is saying we're doing away with so related, and instead we're going to look for a broader relationship. We're going to ask basically whether the person of ordinary skill in the art would have a motivation to combine the two references. And one thing that the court made very clear is that you are allowed to reach outside of the primary and secondary references for evidence of this motivation to combine. I do think that clearly stating that is a difference that will have an impact on how the test is applied in the future.
So did the Federal Circuit leave any open questions?
Yes, I think the Federal Circuit left one quite open question and one sort of question that was previously open but is still open. I think what the court did in terms of its clarification about the definition of analogous art is important. So what the court said was that it's clear that analogous art for a design patent includes art from the, quote, same field of endeavor as the article of manufacture of the claimed design. So if you will recall, in design patents, there's a difference between the concept of the claim design and the underlying article of manufacture. So by way of example, I remember that when BlackBerries were very popular a few years ago, you could buy a BlackBerry, but you could also buy a container of mints that look like a BlackBerry. So in this case, they both have the same design, the BlackBerry design, but one is applied to the cell phone article of manufacture, and the other is applied to a container for holding mints or something like, you know, a metal container for holding mints that were plastic. That would be the other, a different article of manufacture. And I think that illustrates the example that there is a the concept of the design and the concept of the article of manufacture. And what we've seen in some recent cases is that the article of manufacture has taken on additional importance than it used to take on. And so what we see here is that the court is calling analogous prior art, art from the same field of endeavor as the article of manufacture. So that would suggest perhaps that analogous art for the BlackBerry as applied design as applied to the cell phone would be different from the article from the analogous art for a BlackBerry as applied to a container for holding mints or candies. So I think this is a really important difference, but the open question that the court left was, is there something else that might count as analogous art? And the court said there might be other art. We're not foreclosing that possibility, but that is something that's going to be determined on a case-by-case basis. So I think this is important because this idea of what is analogous art potentially becomes a really important question in the obviousness analysis, because if the patent owner is able to knock out an entire class of prior art as being analogous, then they don't even have to get into the visual similarity question. It's reminiscent to me of the In Re Surgisil case, in which the court said that an art tool was not an appropriate anticipatory reference for a lip implant. The two designs were quite similar, but the court said that in the anticipation context. And when I think about that case in terms of this analogous art question, I'm left to wonder, would an art tool be considered something in this other category of analogous art in this, if you're considering the obviousness of a claim design to a lip implant? The other question that the court left open, but like I said a moment ago, didn't really leave open, just kind of confirmed the openness of, was what Kevin mentioned about whether long felt but unresolved needs or failure of others were appropriate secondary considerations for a design patent. We don't usually see those. Usually we see commercial success, industry praise, and copying by competitors, but the court did reaffirm that these other two were kind of on the table, but we hadn't seen those used yet.
Well, so where do design patent holders or applicants go from here? And what about those challenging design patents?
Sure. So for those applying for design patents, the PTO in record time has already issued some interim guidance about how they plan to apply this test. So I think that signals that they are training the examiners and that we may see some more obviousness challenges during prosecution than we did in the past. But I think what's important to keep in mind is obviousness challenges are kind of few and far between in the design patent world. There was a paper that Professor Mark Janis, who's at Indiana, released in 2013, where he found from a FOIA request that he did that less than 3% of design applications were rejected on obviousness grounds. So I think it's entirely possible that we will see more of them. I do not necessarily think, though, even if they were to double to 6%, that is still a lot. That it still doesn't feel to me like a lot of obviousness rejections. However, I think what the LKQ opinion has done is provided those applicants with more options. They have additional tools. They have additional ideas, I think, about how to counter or to argue against an obviousness rejection if one arose during prosecution. With respect to litigators, I think it's time to roll up your sleeves. It's time to make sure that you're gathering the right evidence. If you are the design patent owner, you know, get your secondary considerations together. If you are challenging a design patent, work on that motivation to combine. You know, there's a lot of guidance in the opinion about how to do this, but it starts early in discovery. You need to gather the appropriate evidence. And then I think now more than ever, you need to have a talented design expert who's able to translate that evidence in a way that the jury can really understand whichever side you are arguing. I also think there's a possibility that this will continue the reinvigoration of design patent claim construction. I think that smart litigants are going to look seriously at whether or not to ask the court for some sort of construction regarding the article of manufacture. We saw this in terms of Curver and Surgisil cases that came out in the last couple of years, where a definition of the article of manufacture was important for the infringement question. I think a definition of the article of manufacture is also now going to be important for the analogous art question. And so I think you're going to see more. I mean, I've seen more activity in design patent claim construction in the last few years, and I think that that will only be further invigorated by this decision.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. Beth and Kevin, thank you so much. Our guests have been Kevin Rotke and Beth Farrell of Finnegan, one of the largest IP law firms in the world. For more commentary on intellectual property news and issues, to listen to other podcasts, and to receive additional information on the firm, please visit www.finnegan.com. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Finnegan.